Welcome to Apostrophe Cast. This episode, we're pleased to bring you the short fiction of Claudia Smith. Smith's stories begin innocently enough, but soon her perfectly selected details lead her characters and listeners alike to the edge of transgression and into the wilderness beyond. Listen if you dare. Please enjoy Claudia Smith.
Hook. I was aware of the man before I could see him. Felt him, really, and knew right away how he was thinking of me. We were at the Rexall's drugstore down the street. He was behind me in the hair section. I didn't turn around. I picked up a bottle of Prel shampoo and read the label. As I was reading, I saw a hard glass reflection in my mind's eye, a view of me from the back, a small girl in a short pleated skirt, cotton blouse, penny loafers without socks that revealed nice ankles, thin legs, dark golden pigtail that showed a white part and slender neck. I knew what he wanted, too, and that it was probably only a passing thought. I thought I could change things. Hook-a-man, that was what my Uncle Tripp called it. He said a woman had hooked him once, like spearing a bait onto a fish hook. Even his mother, he said, had done this to a man once. Reeled him in with her pineapple upside-down cake. That's what I'm doing, I thought, hooking. I kept pretending to read, leaning into my foot, then standing crookedly, one loafer on its side, like a kid. I put the shampoo bottle back and rose on my tiptoes, reaching for something on the top shelf. He cleared his throat. "Need some help?" he asked. I fell back on my heels. "Oh, thank you," I said. "Which one do you want?" "That one," I said, pointing to a bottle of hairspray. "For my mom," I said, "not me." He handed me the bottle. I looked up at him and smiled. He was tall. He swallowed, and I watched the lump in his throat wobble. He was in his early 30s, maybe even late 20s, I decided. His hair was dark brown, almost black, very curly, streaked with gray at the temples. He was skinny, without the kind of wiry strength that would have made his lankiness attractive. I liked his eyes, though. They were green and distorted behind chunky black glasses. "Oh, this isn't what I thought it was," I said. "It's banana scented. She doesn't like that kind, but thanks anyway." "Here, I'll put it back," he said, taking it. "Do you live around here?" I asked, looking at him sideways through my crook's eye. "What?" "Oh, sorry, I was just wondering. For my mom, you know, I just thought you seemed nice." "Well, thank you, I like to think so." "My mom is single," I added, "so I like to help her out with dates. I want to buy her a birthday present. I don't have a lot of money, though. Do you think drugstore perfume is a cheap gift?" He touched his crumpled hair, considering. "Not at all, but you know your mother, I don't. I thought it would be nice to give her something impractical. She always buys practical things." "Well, that sounds like a very sweet idea to me," he said. "This looks good," I said, picking up a bottle of Windsong. "I like the commercial for this one," I said. "This man holds on to a beautiful lady's scarf because it smells like her, and the song says he can't forget her because her Windsong stays on his mind." "I don't know anything about perfume," he said, and smiled. His teeth were very even, very white. "Do you have a girlfriend?" I asked him. "Yes." "Well, what does she smell like?" "I don't know." "Does she wear perfume?" "I think so." "Does she smell spicy or fruity or like flowers?" He laughed, then shrugged his shoulders. "Spicy, I'd have to say. I think my mother should have something light and flowery. Maybe this one would be good, I said, lifting up a sample bottle and spritzing it. "What do you think?" I asked him, holding up my wrist for him. He sniffed. "Smells pretty," he said. I pressed my wrist to my nose, breathing in its cloying scent. "Ugh," I said, "too sweet." I sprayed another atomizer into my wrist and held it up to him again. His hand shook as he held my hand, palm open to his face. He took it into his own and pressed it against his face, wrist against lips. "This is lighter," he said. I jerked my hand back, smelling. "Nah," I said, "I think it's because they're too cheap. I'll have to get her something else." I watched as he bought some antihistamines and shaving cream. "Do you have allergies?" I asked him. "Yes." He looked down at me, smiling. He didn't want me to go. "Well, are you allergic to ice cream?" I asked. "No." "I was going to get some ice cream after this. I have enough for both of us. Do you want some?" He glanced at his watch and then looked around the empty aisles. He seemed flustered. "Why not?" he said. "I have time. My treat," he added. "Thanks," I said, focusing on Madge's red and gold badge as she rang up the sale. When we stepped outside, his glasses steamed. He paused, wiped them off with the tail of his shirt, squinted, and readjusted them. Then he took a crumpled tissue from his pocket and blew his nose. He looked down at me, bemused. "How old are you?" he asked. 15, I lied. Knowing he knew I lied, but also knowing he didn't know I knew, I crossed my arms over my breasts. He wanted me young, even younger than I really was. I ordered a double scoop, rum raisin and mocha. He watched me as I ate, and I was careful, neat, licking the tips of my fingers, wiping the corners of my mouth, taking little bites so the ice cream would last. I sat on one foot and let the other one swing back and forth. The chairs in the Baskin-Robbins were shaped like little school desks. He licked his chocolate cone quickly, eyes fixed on my mouth. He was hooked. I knew this completely, but I still hoped I might be wrong. "So you have a girlfriend," I said. "Yes." "So I guess you wouldn't be interested in a blind date with my mom." "No, but I'm honored you'd think me suitable," he said, in a formal, artificially chivalrous way. His voice seemed to come from somewhere behind him. "That's okay. To be honest, she wouldn't go out with you anyway. She's dating a real jerk right now." The lies were coming easily. "That can be rough. I can't stand him," I added. After we'd finished, I walked him to his car. "Do you need a ride anywhere?" he asked, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. "A ride home would be nice," I said. He held the car door open for me, my legs stuck to the hot vinyl seats. "Where do you live?" he asked, pulling out of the parking lot. He was a nervous driver, or maybe I made him nervous. "Just take me to the park," I said. "I don't want to go home." "You mean the one behind the schoolyard?" "Yeah, that one." And then it happened so effortlessly. As he pulled into a residential neighborhood, I brushed his leg with the tips of my fingers as softly as I could so that he could ignore it if he wanted to. He circled my hand with his, and his grasp was light, supplicating. I didn't resist. "I'm sorry," I said. "I need money." I felt his hand tremor, and I wondered if I'd said the wrong thing, if he'd ever done anything like this before. I didn't look at him, but stared at the back of the hand covering mine. It was hairy, even the knuckles were hairy and very white. The fingers were bony and tapering and rounded like spoons. A boy in my class, Tim Loudermilk, had fingers like that. "How much?" he asked. I bit my lip, waiting. There was still time to pretend I hadn't said anything, to get out of the car. I knew he would let me out, that he wouldn't make me do anything. I could tell he didn't want to hurt me. "I don't know," I said. "A lot. I'm sorry," I repeated. "We need it, though. My mom and me. We need it." He swallowed audibly. $200, I said. $200. "I can take that much out," he said. I didn't know what he meant. "Of the bank. You'll have to wait, though. Do you mind waiting in the car? There's a branch only a few miles away." "Yeah," I said. "I can wait." His back straightened, and we drove the rest of the way in silence. It felt safer now, probably for him as well, knowing we had made a decision. He pulled into the bank. There were only a few cars in the lot. "I won't be long," he said. "I'll leave the car on for you so you can have air conditioning. You can listen to the radio if you want." "Okay." I turned on the radio after he left. It was tuned into the easy listening station. I watched his back as he entered the building. He was too tall for his jacket. The sleeves didn't meet his wrists. Neck hairs curled in the collar of his shirt. His gait was loose and fluid. It gave his skinny body a kind of grace. He looked better when he was moving. When he came out, he wasn't smiling. He handed me the money as soon as he jumped into the car. We didn't speak for several minutes. "I can't take you home with me," he said. "I know." I rested my hand against his thigh and then felt another shiver pass over his body. We drove for a while. He pulled onto the freeway. I closed my eyes, not wanting to know how we were getting to wherever we were going. When I felt the car slow, I opened them and saw that we were passing a strip of motels. He pulled into one that seemed abandoned. I scanned the buildings, sandy-colored cinder block boxes. A huge cement parrot perched on the entrance sign. There was also a swimming pool filled with dirty water. "Jesus," he whispered, "Jesus Christ." We pulled into the circular driveway. "Wait in the car," he said. I ducked my head down and waited for him to come back. It seemed to take a long time. We drove to the back row of buildings. There were no other cars. I followed him into the room. It smelled of mildew. The room had its own air conditioning unit, and he switched it on to full blast. The carpet was deep and ugly brown-orange, like old rust. The walls were puce. There were two twin beds. One was missing a headboard. I sat down on one of the beds, pushing my shoes off with the soles of my feet. He sat down next to me, then cracked his knuckles. I almost jumped at the sound they made, a popping noise, like a pop gun. He didn't move. Finally, I reached up and lifted the glasses off his face. He seemed so scared. I rested his glasses on the bed table and then sat on his lap and wrapped my legs around his waist, closed my eyes. His hands shook against my back and he pressed them into my shoulders. His breath was shallow, whispery against my neck. "What is your name?" he said, so softly he sounded as if he were speaking to himself. "Jennifer," I answered without stopping to think. "Jennifer," he whispered, "Jenny." He didn't take my clothes off, and he kept his pants on. All he did was rub against my panties until I felt my underwear slightly dampen. Then his whole body shook, and he began kissing me, my throat, my eyes, my braid. He pressed my face into his chest. "God, God," I felt the huge Adam's apple convulsing against my fingers. "Jenny." When he was finished, he started to whimper. "Please," I said, "don't feel bad." I rolled off of him, touched his curly hair. It felt rough. "God, Jennifer," he said, "how old are you?" "I'm not a little girl," I said. "I'm a teenager. Don't feel bad." "God, I told you, and this isn't the first time either, so don't feel bad," I repeated. And I pulled his sad face into my lap. I felt something open and shut inside me, a physical opening and closing like a valve in my heart. It wasn't love that I felt. Of course it couldn't have been. But it was something like love, a mixture of gratefulness and yearning. I told him thank you and asked him to drop me off somewhere close to my house. I thought, as we passed the Rexels, Dot's coffee shop, and the English Heirs' apartments, that everything might look different, but each building was the same. I told him to stop at Dot's parking lot. There were a few parked cars and a delivery truck. The three scattered palm trees at the edge of the lot were yellowed and dried up looking. I wondered if they always looked that way. I couldn't remember. It had been rainy, and those dead-looking trees didn't make sense to me, but I didn't know much about the lives of palm trees. I didn't look back or wave as I walked away from his car and didn't think about what had just happened. I was only thinking of the bare fact, the real, true fact, that there were two $100 bills tucked in the heel of my loafers. Better not step in any puddles, I thought. Galveston. They can drive all the way to Galveston if they want to, and they do. Mom ties a red scarf around her hair and rolls the windows down. The girls, Marnie and Jolene, sing songs they learned at their first Girl Scout campout last summer. They argue over the words. John Jacob Jingleheimer Smits or Smith. His name is my name, too. Is it Smits or Smith? It's fun to argue. They can do it for as long as they want when their dad isn't there, and so they do. They make up Mad Libs in the car. They use words like bra or fart or sex to make the stories funny. Mom turns on the radio. They laugh about that song the old sleaze Conway Twitty sings. And as I taste your tender kisses, I can tell you've never been this far before. They take the ferry and throw a loaf of bread to the gulls. Jolene watches the dolphins follow the wake of the boat, and Marnie stands at the mast because she loves getting splashed. They drive all the way out to the Bolivar Peninsula. There's a beach house for rent. It's all one room with a little avocado-colored kitchenette and a bathroom full of seashells. They'll all share the big bed. The place smells musty but beachy, like wet sand. There's a balcony. If they'd come here in the summertime, they could have slept out on it. "Maybe we can come in the summertime," Marnie says. "Maybe we can move here. We'll put out crab traps. We can have a bonfire and make s'mores. We can plant a watermelon patch." Mom puts it on the plastic. It's cold, so everything's cheap. The ocean is gray and rolling. The best time for the beach, Mom says. We have it to ourselves. They walk to the corner store. They buy corn pops and weenies and canned beans. Mom buys a stack of paperback romances. They'll go out for seafood tomorrow. They'll go to the Strand and put t-shirts on the plastic. The field around the beach house is full of sticker burrs. They run barefoot across the field to test how much pain they can stand. They can't make it all the way to the beach. It hurts too bad. They turn back, pull out the stickers from the soles of their feet. Jolene makes monkey noises as she picks Marnie's feet. "I'll bet we can harden up," Marnie says. "We do it enough and we'll be beach girls. It'll make calluses." It's too cold to go barefoot on the beach, Mom tells them. She wears a light jacket, and the girls throw towels around their shoulders to keep warm because they didn't pack properly. It's cold, but the cold feels good. It bites them and keeps them awake. The girls dip their fingers in the water and shiver. They fill their jean pockets with shells. Mom watches and doesn't follow. Her mood is changing. She says she's pensive. They eat corn pops when they get back. Mom makes them instant hot chocolate. She says the Swiss Miss looks just like her girls. The house has a radio with a cassette player, so they listen to their Dolly Parton tape, the one with Jolene on it, and then they listen to Crystal Gayle. It's too cold, though. They can't sleep. Mom does the old trick. She opens the oven and they sit in front of it, treat it like a space heater. She makes more hot chocolate. It's fun, isn't it, Mom? Marnie says. It's like a camp out, but better, because we're at the beach. Mom looks bad. She's too thin. She doesn't look pretty now because her face is collapsed. When she's tired and just with the girls, sometimes her face wrinkles up. The girls can't see bruises, but Marnie knows if she took her shirt off, you would see them on her back. They sing Mom's favorite song. They try to make it good. They know she likes it when they sound pretty. She loves Glen Campbell. They can't remember all the words. Galveston, oh Galveston, they sing. I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Do you know what that song's about? Mom asks them. It's a love song, Marnie says. It's about a man in Vietnam. He's afraid of dying, and he's missing the girl he loves. Isn't that sad? Mom says. Yeah, the girls say. Time for bed, she tells them. The mattress smells of wet dog, and the sheets are sandy. They sleep in their socks and pants. Mom puts the Crystal Gayle tape in again. The girls watch her through half-closed eyes. She paces. She walks in and out of the house. She walks funny, like she's drunk or hurt, but she's not. She needs to think. At home, when he's gone, she sits in the silver light of the television with the sound turned down and smokes. But there's no television here. She's going to call him, Marnie whispers. No, she won't, Jolene says. Shh. If she walks out to the balcony one more time, she's calling him, Marnie tells her. How do you know? Jolene asks. But Marnie always knows. She does go out to the balcony. They can hear the ocean, even after she closes the door. Hole. Obadiah Edelman lives two blocks down from me. His parents own their own house. They don't rent like us. His mom's a resident at Texas Children's. That's a hospital, the one where I had to go for my concussion last year. His mom paid my mom to watch him and his baby brother for a while, but now he's in school. Even though he's only 3 months older than I am, he can read and write in cursive, and he likes books without pictures. He is a boy genius. I call him Obi. It's better to play at his house because he has a big television, the kind that looks like a piece of furniture. And lots of good things in the fridge we can just eat whenever we want to. When I used to have to stay sometimes at Tammy's down the street, I could eat anything from the fridge because Tammy's mom said my mom wasn't paying her to watch me. But Obi's mom doesn't care. She has good stuff from the co-op, dried fruit and bean sprouts she grows on the counter. She wears a white coat and she has dark hair that shines like it's polished and blue eyes just like Obi's. And Obi's room is painted like a jungle, with monkeys and banana trees on the walls, and a styrofoam model of the planets his dad helped him make. He knows all the planets, and he tried to teach me, but I could only remember Jupiter, because it's so big. When I try to imagine how big it is, I get the shivers. There's a whirling storm on Jupiter. It's called the Red Spot. I told Obi all about Noah's Ark and the Flood when he said it was not a believable story. But sometimes we close the door and pretend that the jungle in his room is paradise, and I'm Cain, and he's Abel, and that's pretty fun, because he doesn't really know the story like I do, so he doesn't care if I change it around sometimes. Like I'll eat a magic apple, and it will be so good it drives me to insanity, and I pick up a baseball bat, which is my club, and kill him, because the apple is so good I won't share it. My mother stays late for coffee sometimes when my dad is gone, and Obi's dad is working late at the hospital, because he's a doctor too. When it gets late, we get to eat SpaghettiOs and watch Police Woman. Our mothers stay in the kitchen talking. If we act like we aren't listening, we can spy on them, but if we're too quiet, they will catch us. Obi's mom said once that his dad would be gone all night because he was eating lobster at the Crystal Pistol. What's the Crystal Pistol, I ask Obi when he tells me. It is a place where beautiful women like policewomen dress up like cowgirls with cowgirl hats and boots with silver spurs and dance like the Dallas Cowgirls. They have pearl-handled guns. They don't wear shirts, and you can see the hair on their vaginas. No, you can't, I say, and I make him cross his heart, which he always thinks is silly. He doesn't make up stories like I do, so I know he is telling the truth. Obi says the women have breasts like soft pillows and the men call them Texas dolls. We go upstairs and open the toy box. Obi doesn't like dress up, but now he wants to play it. If I will be a cowgirl from the Crystal Pistol, which I am, and it's fun to shoot the cap gun at him and dance. But I say if my shirt is off, he has to take off his pants, which he says he doesn't have to do because those are his private parts and I don't have breasts yet. Yeah, I do, I say. He says not until I am sexually mature, and I tell him I know what he means, but I still think it's different if we're playing like I'm a Crystal Pistol. He should just look at the pictures in his dad magazines in the basement. My mom and dad take a bath sometimes, I tell him. He goes downstairs to check on our moms and says they are drinking the red wine from big paper cups, so I'll get to stay for a long time. They won't bother us, so we get a Mr. Bubble Bath ready and blow bubbles all over the room. They disappear like dandelion fluff, and I tell him to make a wish on every bubble, but he can't say the wishes or they won't come true. He asks if he can touch my vagina and I can touch his penis. So okay, we do. I think it's weird, and he says it's interesting. I rub him dry with a big towel until he's so red he looks like he's sunburned. I tell him we're aliens spying on this earth and experimenting with our human bodies. That's the way he likes to pretend, aliens and science stuff. He never likes to play fairies or things like that. So we get dressed and climb out the window of the second story, which by myself would be scary, but with Obi I'm not. Shimmy down the tree, he tells me. What's shimmy, I ask him, and he shows me. I do it perfect. It's more fun to spy like that, to go out the window and watch them from outside. We crawl through the grass and up to the kitchen window. The windows at Obi's house are really beautiful, the kind with panes like little frames, and some are even stained glass. Our moms are sitting at the yellow wood table, and the light over them looks angel soft because they have lamps on and candles burning, but no overhead light. Obi's mom's hair is pulled back with a tortoiseshell clip, and her hair covers her ears, except for her earlobes. She looks pale and gleamy and really beautiful, because her lipstick is the color of the red wine. Like Snow White, you know, all white and black and lips as red as blood. My mom has her head in her fists, and can't see her eyes, but I know they are pink. She's maybe crying. If we go in there, they'll think of us and make me go home. But if we stay watching, they'll maybe stay that way for a long time. It's better to watch them than to hear them. It's embarrassing, Obi says. My mom is telling her about the naked ladies. We crawl to safety, through the hole in the back of the fence, and into the thicket, the briar patch. There are wild blackberries growing and honeysuckle all tangled in the lattice. This is where our hole is dug. We've been digging it for a long time. It's our secret hole. Nobody else who walks the earth has seen it. We use trowels and buckets. It's deep enough for both of us to fit inside, but we're going to dig it so deep it will be like a rabbit hole for us if rabbits were the size of humans. The dirt smells like rust. Obi likes it here as much as I do. He doesn't even say I'm dumb if I eat some of it. We can escape from Alcatraz through our hole in the briar patch, I say, and I push my hand into the earth. Obi covers my wrist with dirt. He's going to bury it up to the elbows. He pats the dirt against me like he's just planted a seed. Bury me whole, I tell him, and wait for him to take off my shoe and sink my foot into the earth. Valentine. You once gave me an apple from off of a tree, and I thought about its significance and wondered if you meant something by that, or if you were just handing me an apple. We were walking my dog, that sweet old boy, and he was just a puppy. I bit right into the apple and you said, hey, shouldn't you wash that first? Last week, I took a boat on the Riverwalk with our son. We floated past weddings, the free weddings they have every year on that day. People were carrying yellow roses and wearing red. I asked him, what is love? He said, Valentine's Day. I said, what do you mean by that? And he answered, happy Valentine's Day. A race car Valentine is better than a heart. He fell asleep with his head in my lap as we floated under bridges, past fig trees and old buildings. When I brought him home after the boat ride, it was late. The light had burned out on our porch, and I stubbed my toe on the steps. I carried him to his bed, putting him down with his Ninja Turtle. I lay down beside him and slept. I came across some toads this morning with our boy. We were walking in the alley. I know you'd tell me that wasn't a good idea, but he wanted to see the recycling bin to make sure we had sorted it all properly. The toads were ugly, and that made them cuter than any apple green frog. Are toads solitary creatures? I guess I'll have to look it up on the internet. I'd never seen so many together like that. They were huddling. Maybe they were going to mate. Maybe it was a toad orgy. You gave me a typewriter once. Remember that? I said I wanted to write, and I didn't have a computer, and you had an old brother typewriter, and you said I could have it. We were sitting on the floor because I had no furniture. And I started typing about the cool computer that a boy just gave me. I kept typing, and you were watching. You kept watching me type, and my hands were shaking. I said it was from all the coffee, and I was waiting for you to kiss me. Instead, we stayed up all night, talking, me waiting for you to kiss me or go home, until we fell asleep together on the floor, which was covered with some kind of cheap industrial carpet. I woke up with a crick in my neck and red marks from the scratchy carpet. Your hands were on your stomach, and all your long, dark hair was covering your face. I kissed you then, kissed your forehead. I did it suddenly and softly, startling myself. It was like touching the wings of a creature you couldn't see, but knew to be beautiful, simply from the feel of it. I stood up and walked out of the apartment, down the stairs, into the street. It was cold and I wasn't wearing a coat, but I kept walking anyway, thinking I couldn't go back there because you'd be gone.
Thank you for listening. Please join us on August 5th for Alice and Titus.